Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
The dream season is now complete. The Golden State Warriors are the 2015 NBA champions. Their first title in 40 years.
The Golden State Warriors clinched the title in Game 6 of the NBA Finals last night with a victory over the Cleveland Cavaliers. That takes amazing talent, amazing drive. And there's something else everyone's looking for in the NBA and beyond these days. Flow, mindfulness. George Mumford teaches it in the NBA. Kobe, Shaq, Michael Jordan all say meditation changed their game. This hour on Point, the guru who transforms athletes' headspace on the power of a free, focused mind, the power of flow. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your question for the mindfulness guru to the NBA? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is George Mumford, the author of The Mindful Athlete, Secrets to Pure Performance. He's a mindfulness teacher and sports psychology consultant who has worked with many basketball greats. He's currently working with Phil Jackson and the New York Knicks. George Mumford, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. I was so interested in your story, how you got involved with the NBA in the first place and all that came before that in your own youth and prisons. And it's a great story. We'll dive into it. Help us think about that victory and loss last night. The NBA championship goes to the Golden State Warriors. The Cavaliers, after all of LeBron's effort, have to deal with failure. When that time comes, no matter what preparation you've done with players in the NBA in advance, does mindfulness stick around when it comes to the exaltation of victory, the agony of defeat, or is that does everything fall away for celebration or sorrow?
I think the latter, celebration or sorrow, because the way life is when it's very pleasant, it's easy to be in the moment and to enjoy it. But when it's the agony of defeat, the last thing you want to do is remember how you're feeling.
Yes.
And it's interesting because if you listen to people who have gone through that, I'm thinking of Coach Popovich, is when they lost to the Miami Heat a couple of years ago, that stays with you longer than the victory, because the victory, you can celebrate it, but then this season starts and then you're on to another conquest or another quest. But when you lose, it's just hard, because the more you try to get rid of those feelings, the more you try to get away from it, the longer it lingers, whatever we resist, persist. So it's a very painful time for the Cleveland Cavaliers, although they've won really, you know, they have had a great season given what they had and what they had to work with. But it's painful.
An amazing effort from LeBron James there. You've worked with so many greats in the NBA on this front. And it's interesting, we wanted to talk with you today in part to hear that story about working with NBA greats, but in part because this whole conversation about mindfulness and flow has gotten so deep and wide in the culture now. But yes, in the NBA, L.A. Lakers star Kobe Bryant has been very open about discussing mindfulness in his game. He's even teamed up with Arianna Huffington to teach meditation classes, and you know Kobe well. Here's Kobe Bryant in a video for the class posted online last month.
I meditate every day. I do it in the mornings, and I do it for about 10 to 15 minutes. And I think it's important because it sets me up for the rest of the day. It's like having an anchor. You know, if I don't do it, I feel like I'm constantly chasing the day.
If I don't do it, I feel like I'm constantly chasing the day or maybe the ball. My guest, George Mumford, taught Kobe Bryant and many others, worked with Shaquille O'Neal, worked with Michael Jordan and lots of others. George, when you watch a game, can you see whether a team or a player is got the flow? Is it clear to you? Do you have a kind of a, you know, Yoda X-ray here?
Yes, I think everybody recognizes it because there's an ease, there's a flow, there's a rhythm, there's an ability to be in the moment from moment to moment. So there's no getting really upset about things not going well or getting too excited. If things go well, it's just a matter of just taking each thing as it comes and just flowing with it. Just it's like being in the current of a stream. You're just flowing with it. You're not trying to do anything. You're just allowing things to happen. Like in Zen and Art of Archery, the author talks about it shoots. You know, when you are doing archery, and so that's what happens. There's no self consciousness. You're just allowing things to happen, and you're just rolling with it.
When you sit down with these big, talented, very successful players, by definition, if they're in the NBA, they've come a long way, and maybe a long way without thinking about mindfulness or flow.
Right.
When you sit down with them to talk about it, are they open? Were they open, what is it, almost 20 years ago when you began doing this work in the NBA?
Yes, because everybody knows what it feels like to be in flow. When you talked about flow and how you may access flow, because it's very challenging, because the more you try to get into flow, the more you won't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of these things, it's a paradox. But if you can pay attention to be in a moment and allow things to happen, but you have to be prepared for that moment. So all your training, your skills and knowledge have to be, you have to have access to them in the moment of competition. So it's like just being prepared, but then allowing your preparation to express itself. So one thing is to allow whatever is happening to speak to you, but then in that speaking to you, being able, in this relaxed receptivity, this quietness, that you're able to just allow your training to express itself appropriately as things arise.
It's obviously not only for athletes.
It's for everybody.
Does it rely on what Kobe Bryant was talking about there, that 10 or 15 minutes of active, deliberate meditation in the course of a day?
Yes. You have to be able to, I like to use the analogy of the eye of the hurricane and have access to that stillness, that silence. And I mean, this is not something new. In the Bible, it talks about be still and know.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of on that order, is mm-hmm. that by, if you're right-handed, let's say, and your left brain is the linear brain, it's the words to the song that's constantly going. It doesn't stop. And the right brain, which could be the melody or seeing the whole picture or where our intuition mm-hmm. or just knowing without understanding how we know, that doesn't get a chance, or the still small voice we talk about a lot.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That gets drowned out by the left brain. So when you're able to sit, be still and know, or to meditate, or to just be with what you're doing, just focusing on one thing, then that left brain gets quieted down and the right brain has a chance to come in and you have access to it. So it's slowing the mind down and getting out of this reactive phase where there's a stimulus and an immediate reaction. So you actually create space, as Viktor Frankl talked about, between stimulus and response, so that you're able to choose and pick and choose within that space how are you going to, what choice are you going to make, how are you going to be,
mm-hmm.
which is consistent with what your values are or what your goals are, versus being in a knee-jerk, habitual, automatic pilot reaction, which there's no room for the cerebral cortex or your thinking brain to have impact.
How long does it take you, as a kind of guru of all this, to figure out if a player or anybody that you meet is operating in that way, or whether they're just bouncing?
You can tell because their body language, there's an effortlessness, there's an ease, there's a flow, there's a confidence, and there's a quietness. Even though they might be in the middle of chaos, it's like the eye of the hurricane, there's this ease and there's this being in the body and just flowing with things. There's an effortlessness about it. You can see it.
Was Michael Jordan open to this when you first began to talk with him and other of the Chicago Bulls about it? I guess Phil Jackson invited you?
Yes. Well, Michael wasn't there for the first 18 months, but mm-hmm. when he came back, yes, because I suspect I was able to explain to him what most of his time playing is about, explaining what flow is, explaining, you know, how it works, how to access it. But he already knew. It was just a matter of me making it more conscious and saying that as much flow as you've had, you can have more.
Thinking of Michael Jordan, that sounds like a lot. George Mumford is with us, kind of mindfulness guru to many NBA players and beyond. His new book is The Mindful Athlete. Walter's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Walter, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
In Bill Russell, in his book Second Wind, talks about having holographic abilities. He would see a basketball player on the court, close his eyes, and he said, on his eyelids, he could see the video of what he saw, and he could play it over and over and over again. But the most remarkable thing, he would then ask for that image to disappear, to be replaced by his image. Then he would see himself play the same move over and over again, like a video. Then he would go on the court and do the same move effortlessly. It's only a few paragraphs, but it blew my mind when I read it.
Bill Russell was on the show a couple of years back. He blew my mind just talking with him. What a wonderful guy. What a wonderful mind. And, of course, athlete. Walter, I appreciate your call. George Mumford, that kind of visualization, does that relate to mindfulness or is that something else?
Yes. Well, one thing to keep in mind is that our brains do not know the difference between what we think about and what we experience. And so just by... But, of course, you have to have ability. So I know about this because I grew up watching Bill Russell win most of his championships. I could actually say I was at the last home game in 1969 when he played for the Celtics. That I read his book. I've read his book many times, and he talks about being in flow. And he talks about this playing or what I would call mental rehearsal or using the mind because the brain doesn't know the difference between what we think and what we experience by thinking about it, by reflecting, by doing what we call kinesthetic visualization. In other words, visualizing yourself from inside your body and seeing yourself go through it and using your visual, your auditory, your kinesthetic sense.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the power of a free, focused mind with mindfulness teacher to the stars of the NBA, George Mumford. He's taught Michael Jordan, Shaquille O'Neal, Kobe Bryant. He may have something to teach you. His new book is The Mindful Athlete, Secrets to Pure Performance. Here's an interesting moment. Game-winning shot from Michael Jordan in Game 6 of the 1998 championship finals between the Bulls and the Utah Jazz. It was a moment Jordan later chalked up to Zen Buddhism stuff in an interview with Ahmad Rashad.
17 seconds from Game 7 or from championship number 6. Jordan, open, Chicago with the lead! Timeout, Utah. 5.2 seconds left. Michael Jordan running on fumes with 45 points.
Beautiful, beautiful play, and he gave credit to the Zen Buddhism stuff. You can trace that back to my guest, George Mumford. Tight with Phil Jackson, here's often called the Zen master in the NBA. Jackson sat down with Oprah Winfrey in 2013, explained how he coaches his players' mental strength, how mindfulness comes into it.
You know, as much as we pump iron and we run to build our strength up, we need to build our mental strength up. We need to build our mental strength so we can focus, get one-pointed attention, and so that we can be in concert with one another in times of need. Mm-hmm. When you come off the court, you've had a bad call, things going wrong for you, you sit on the bench, you take a breath, you reset yourself, and you do that through this mindfulness.
There, Phil Jackson, the Zen master. We've got Jim Clemens with us from Los Angeles in just a moment here. George Mumford with me in the studio, his new book, The Mindful Athlete. How did you get hooked up with Phil Jackson in the first place? You played ball in high school. You got mixed up in drugs in college years and early working years. You got into the mindfulness and meditation. You were advising, talking to prisoners a lot about it. And then this connection.
Yes. At the time, I was working for the Center for Mindfulness, which is what it's called now, but in the day it was called the Stress Reduction and Relaxation Program, part of UMass Medical Center. And my boss at the time, John Kabat-Zinn, was given a teaching.
Big name in this world.
Yes, given a teaching mindfulness-based stress reduction to clinicians. And Phil's wife at the time, June Jackson, was attending it, and she knew that Phil wanted to bring somebody in to help the team work with the stress of success because they had just won their first three NBA championships in a row. So they decided on me, and I talked to Phil, and then the rest is history. I went to the Bulls training camp, and they were in full-blown crisis because Michael had retired because his father had been murdered.
Yeah.
And that was 22 years ago almost.
And here you were with all of your hard-won expertise on this front.
Right.
And then that unusual thing, an African-American in this arena, which is not exactly your everyday right. sort of meditation guru image.
Right. Yes. It didn't hurt that I was roommates with Dr. J in college, so I pretty
Julius
much,
Irving.
Julius Irving.
So you knew basketball, you knew Irving, you knew this world.
Right.
When the players saw you, they saw someone who maybe understood them.
Right. That's exactly right. And also looked like them, or at least understood the game, or understood what the requirements were to play at a high level, because I lived with it, I've been around it.
George Mumford brought it, and he's worked with many of Phil Jackson's players ever since. With us from Los Angeles right now, Jim Clemens, retired NBA player. Clemens joined the New York Knicks coaching staff under Derek Fisher last year. He worked as an assistant coach for the Chicago Bulls from 89 to 96. He was head coach of the Dallas Mavericks back in 96, 97. Knows the work of George Mumford. Jim Clemens, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Have you seen George work with the players, and with what results, sir?
Well, we've seen George work firsthand with the players, even sit in on some of his sessions as a staff, and we've been fortunate enough to have wonderful success with George and his methodology and how he teaches and how he's able to connect with our players both on and off the floor.
A good player, as George says, they know the flow when they're in it. What does George bring that helps them get into the flow more often?
Well, I think that more often than not, we carry images in our mind, good and sometimes less than positive. And George is through his technology and methodology is able to help us keep the good, see the less than positive, mm-hmm. understand what's happening with us, and then come and hit the reset button or refocus button and let that go and now move forward.
Have you found, Jim Clemens, that most players are open to this? Are some resistant? What makes the difference?
Well, I think it's it varies from player to player, and there's nothing like success to for reinforcement. We all live in a very stressful environment and competitive environment, and those of us are open to new ways of thought, and change, mm-hmm. not necessarily happens overnight, but through one success at a time. I think people who are in touch with their surroundings and those of us that want to become better at our craft begin to see that there is something to it, and if you're not afraid to walk slowly and experiment with it in your own particular situations, you begin to trust another element of, mm-hmm. of success. And through trusting, you start to believe and you see changes in behavior and understanding of both your position and status and those around you. And it becomes you begin to conspire. Yeah. Okay, George, hitting all the buttons.
Yes, yes. And it's good for the team.
It's a way of teaching, mm-hmm. and you have to be open. If you're not open, you won't have the success that can ultimately come your way. And it doesn't happen overnight. See, once again, in our mm-hmm. culture, we're looking for the magic bullet. We were looking for something that happens overnight. And once again, nothing happens overnight. You have to be patient. You have to be taught. You have to learn how to use the breath. You have to have the common experiences. And at the other end of it, you have to want the success of paying due diligence and understanding and be able to work through the stresses that we all have in our lives.
Sure.
Now, whether we are NBA basketball players, elementary teachers, college professors, the local mechanic, whatever, is being able to, once again, finding that spot, that moment that you can just breathe, understand, refocus, and then continue.
George Mumford, say hi to Jim Clemens. He must have been there when you came to the Bulls. Was Jim Clemens open to what you brought, George?
Yes, Jim was open. Hey, Jim. And Jim, what he didn't tell you was we also continued to work together on the Lakers.
Oh, terrific.
So Jim has been a part of the staff off and on throughout the 21-plus years that I've been working with Phil. And we've had multiple, many conversations about everything.
Yes, no doubt.
Yes.
The heat comes on, the pressure, the challenge, it's all there. And if you can find your breath within that, as Jim says, so much the better.
Yes. Well, we only live in the moment. So the more we can be in the moment and be with what is, the more we can express ourselves.
Jim, do you practice this yourself, sir?
I've been aware of mindfulness since I was in college. I had a teammate of mine who talked about visualization and focusing. Mm-hmm. It helped him with his shot. And I'd been doing it even in my practice, but didn't know what to call it. And so once I had an opportunity for one of my college teammates, and it actually happened my freshman year in college, and I saw it working with him on his shot, then I realized I wasn't fantasizing. There was nothing wrong with me, that there is such a process out there. And really, I guess I've been doing it my entire athletic career because I've been able to focus because I wasn't a good basketball player. And I had to use all the resources around me to enhance my skills. And it has come, I'm going to say, rather naturally for me. But at the same point in time, to be able to have someone who teaches it and explain some of the things that I was feeling as a young athlete and now carrying through my professional career, and now I'm been a teacher for almost mm-hmm. the last 30 years, is certainly a tool in the toolbox that if you can know how and when to call on it in your skills and you're dealing with young people, it certainly can help.
Jim Clements, who's been with the Bulls and the Mavericks, the Knicks right now, the Lakers, you're so good to join us for a few minutes today. Thank you so much for coming on, Jim.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Max in Nashville, Tennessee. Max, you're on the air with George Mumford.
Hey, Tom. I would like to move a little bit from Jackson, who is awesome in Buddha, who's also a great, the whole Zen thing is very interesting.
Yeah.
But, you know, Steph Curry went to a small Presbyterian school mm-hmm. in North Carolina. And, you know, the prayer, I know, like, mindful meditation is perhaps, you know, a great big difference between that and prayer. But regular meditation and prayer, not that Presbyterians are very evangelical or anything, but...
Still pray, still pray.
But they pray, right, exactly. And some say, you know, go in for the Ten Commandments, or at least eight out of ten, or something like that. So, so I was interested, especially with Steph Curry, who Davidson's a very, very academic school, and a lot of NBA players don't necessarily get that rigorous workout. But
yeah.
Also, again, being a Presbyterian college, wondered if that played a role, or if you knew, and how prayer and meditation and mindful meditation in particular might work together.
Max, I'm glad you raised that. George and I were talking about that just before the show, whether there are other paths to this. What about prayer as an alternative or a substitute to Buddhist-style meditation mindfulness, George?
Yes. Well, the interesting thing is mindfulness by itself is not enough. But when you look at it in the context of how I teach it, within the context of how the Buddha talked about it, is it is what is called the threefold training. One is training in wisdom, obviously. The second one is training in ethical conduct. And the third one is what we know, mental training. And so the interesting thing is they're all connected and all related. So prayer is a form of what we would call right intention, intentions of non-harm, intentions of generosity, mm-hmm. Intentions of compassion.
Mm-hmm.
So prayer is like right thinking. When you pray... And it's all about doing good, avoiding evil, and purifying the mind and the heart. So a lot of these wisdom traditions, when they talk about commandments, or in the Buddhist tradition, they talk about the precepts. It's about your word, thought, and deeds being consistent with the greater good. And
mm-hmm.
and so, for instance, so there's a lot of greed. So you're really about renunciation or generosity. There's a lot of ill will or hate. It's about goodwill and seeing self in other. So all of this is very important. And so when we pray and we think about how we are all one, or we are connected, beyond this illusion of separateness, and that we're looking for the greater good, or we're asking, because the laws are written in the heart, if you talk about the Christian. So we all have a Christ consciousness, a Buddha nature. So the way to access that is through prayer and meditation. And some people consider meditation just being still and listening, be still and know. And some form of prayer is about, you know, asking for thy will, not mine. And in that sense, it's about what's wholesome, what is skillful, what leads to harmony versus distress. So they're very much connected, and we have a tendency to separate or think that meditation or mindfulness is just one thing. But I would say, like Dr. Dre, you know, if you have your mind on money, then you have money on your mind. So if you have prayer on your mind, if you have goodwill of wanting others to or seeing the goodness in others, meeting people with love and blessings, then that's a living prayer.
We've got Jesus, the Buddha, Dr. Dre, George Mumford, all in our mind right here, right now. Sarah Lazar joins us right now from Boston. She's a neuroscientist at Massachusetts General Hospital, assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School, researches the effects of meditation on the brain. Sarah Lazar, thank you very much for joining us for a minute here.
Thank you for having me.
What happens to the brain when there's steady, disciplined meditation going on?
There are some very specific changes in brain gray matter structure that happen in the course of just a few weeks. And one of the most interesting changes is that the amygdala, which is the fight-or-flight part of the brain, gets smaller. And this change in the amygdala is correlated with a change in stress. And so this really tells us that when people go through these courses for stress reduction purposes, that there's a real biological reason why they're reporting the stress reduction. They're not just saying it because they feel better or because time has passed.
So it's not just they read in a magazine that they should feel different, and so they do. You see the brain actually changing. What did you find about the discipline itself of meditation? Does it have to be a particular kind or of a particular quality to produce this physiological change in the brain, Sarah?
So far, we've only studied mindfulness. We actually studied people going through the 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction program started by Jon Kabat-Zinn. And so with something we'd like to do in the future is look at other forms of meditation. But right now, all we know about is mindfulness.
And within 8 weeks, you see a perceptible physical change in the brain.
Correct, yeah. And this is similar to other types of learning. You know, so it's not unique to meditation, but it's more the regions that we identified that were interesting.
The amygdala, the fight-or-flight region shrinks. Are there good things that grow?
Yes. So the hippocampus, which is important for learning and memory, and which also plays a role in emotion regulation. Also an area of the brain that's important for seeing things from other people's point of view, is also an area that got bigger. And finally, an area that's involved in mind wandering, which is a little counterintuitive that it should get bigger, but we think that it getting bigger is related to having less mind wandering.
So has all of your direct scientific research made you a kind of believer here, Sarah, in what George is teaching, in his case, to NBA players?
Well, I was already a believer.
Okay.
Yeah. But certainly it helps us understand it a little more from a scientific point of view, and also helps us get a better handle on sort of what's happening when, because things tend to continue to change over time. And so now we sort of understand what's happening in the first 8 weeks of practice.
Our brains are plastic, and the research there from Sarah Lazar finds they actually change in just 8 weeks. The physical change in the brain that might explain change in play or interaction with the world. Sarah Lazar at the Massachusetts General Hospital, Harvard Medical School, thanks so much for joining us for a minute.
Thank you.
George, there's the actual proof in the brain. It's not just in your mind.
Yes, that's very affirming to know that you know things, but now that science is starting to catch up with the fMRIs, you know, the functional MRIs, that we can see the proof. We can see the proof in the eating of the pudding, as they say.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the power of a free and focused mind this hour with mindfulness teacher to the stars of the NBA, George Mumford. He's taught Michael Jordan, Shaquille O'Neal, Kobe Bryant. He may have something to teach you. His new book is The Mindful Athlete, Secrets to Pure Performance. But there are lessons here for folks well outside the realm of sport. George Mumford studied with Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, credited with secularizing the sort of modern meditation movement, runs the Center for Mindfulness in Medicine, Healthcare, and Society. Here he is, Kabat-Zinn, speaking at Dartmouth College just a couple of years back.
If we hope for the future to be different, the only place we have to stand is now. If you want to be in the future, here you are. Because what it invites is a kind of shift in perception and a shift in awareness, a shift in consciousness that allows us to actually live our lives as if they really mattered in the only moment we ever have. And part of that means being embodied.
Be embodied, be in the moment. Jon Kabat-Zinn, who taught George Mumford. George Mumford, who is here with us, who's worked with Phil Jackson. Phil Jackson, who writes in the introduction to The Mindful Athlete, the hardest thing after all the work and all the time spent on training and technique is just being fully present in the moment. Maria in Watertown, Massachusetts, you're on the air with George Mumford.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for your wonderful show and this great program.
Thank you.
And I thought I would call in because I have a little experience with this. I am a longtime rower of over 30 years, mm-hmm. and I used to compete here on the Charles and okay. elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And 30 years ago, I took a class with Jon Kabat-Zinn on meditation mm-hmm. and mindfulness. And after the first class, I said, well, I thought this might help me in my rowing and racing. And he said, that's interesting because I'm teaching it to the Harvard lightweight crew. And they went on to have a 100% successful season of racing. And he also taught it to the Jon Kabat-Zinn, that is, taught it to the 1984 U.S. National rowing team that competed in L.A. at the L.A. Olympics. So Jon Kabat-Zinn is a great human being, and I can't say enough about mindfulness, which is really paying attention and living now and being present.
Maria, it sounds like you got right to the heart of it as a competitive rower. And did it work for you in your own rowing, Maria?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was really helpful. And I also, you know, guided imagery is a fun thing to do as well. And that kind of ties in with mindfulness. And, you know, it helps in everything. It helps in life, driving down the road. And doing what you think is important in life.
Maria, I appreciate your call. Thank you very much for that. George, here's a question from James, who may be in the zone and isn't sure exactly how all this fits together. He says, I've had a few instances of being in the zone where basically it seems impossible to miss a shot. I guess he was playing ball, basketball. But James writes to us on the website, onpointradio.org, but it was anything but mindful. He says, if anything, it was without thought, almost like watching someone else play. I think we're into some kind of semantics here, but unravel that for us a little bit, George.
Yes. It sounds like he's equating mindfulness with self-consciousness. When we're really in the moment, there's no self-consciousness. It's just consciousness. It's just being, like I said, it shoots. It's like we're not there. Time mm-hmm. is altered. So I would say it's not contrary. It is a result of being mindful in a series of moments so that it becomes a flow of mindfulness that's just happening.
Mm. And not contradictory with his mind
right.
feeling disengaged.
Right. Exactly. I'd say that's probably the illusion of separateness has been kind of put in abeyance or put on hold so that where did he go? He's kind of saying like, okay, I wasn't there, so I wasn't mindful. You were mindful because you weren't there.
I mean, this is partly a matter of just words.
Semantics, exactly.
You know, it goes all the right. way back. Where did I read? To some British administrator back in colonial times who was in Sri Lanka or Ceylon in that day, a Buddhist area, who was looking for a word to convey this famous state in Buddhist state of mind to readers back in England.
That's right.
Mindfulness is what he came up with. It may not always convey exactly what he intended.
It does not, because mindfulness has many meanings. The word is sati, S-A-T-I, in Pali. And it's hard to talk about mindfulness because it's pre-thought, and it has some certain qualities that are involved. One quality is steadiness of mind, or, you know, not forgetting what you're doing and not forgetting the present moment. Another aspect of it is presence of mind. It's like a mirror mind. It just reflects what's there. There's, you know, you let things speak to you rather than allowing yourself to interpret what it means. And that's what we do in most of our ordinary consciousness. There's a self-reference, there's abstract thinking, there's
immediate judgment.
Yeah. There's associative thinking, like, oh, this happened before. So what happens, the raw data in a moment, which is only the receptive stage, is very short. It is immediately embellished with our self-reference and this sort of thing. And so what mindfulness does is it creates space between the stimulus and response so that there's more time to actually let the raw data speak to us.
Keep all of our stuff from piling on right away.
That's right. And then, so there is this presence of mind, and then there's also what we call remembering, you know, remembering what's skillful, what's not skillful, remembering the present moment. And then obviously there has to be some intelligence or some wisdom or clearly knowing what it is we're doing and what are the basic principles or the fundamental truths that we are trying to contemplate.
When you sit down with NBA players who have a lot on the line here and a lot of reason if this can work, if they're willing to be open to it, what are the big obstacles you find? And I'm sure they might be similar for all of our listeners, but what are the first obstacles?
Yes. Well, because it's a religion or that...
Oh, they think this is not my religion. This is Buddhist. I'm Christian.
Yes.
So this is not for me.
Do this means that you're Buddhist or that you're... somehow part of a cult, or they call it navel-gazing.
Uh-huh.
They have all of these terms that are contradictory and not consistent with what it really is.
That encourage them at the first to say, nah, not for me.
Yeah, or that it's something that's going to sort of have them lose their self-will, but in actuality it's the opposite. You have more free will
Let's say they get over that idea that this is the other or strange or foreign or contradictory to their religion. What other obstacles come up?
It depends on the person. Sometimes the big obstacle is coming to the realization, and this guy David Bohm talked about it. He said that one of the biggest challenges is when we see things as they are, that we have to admit that the way we were seeing things, there's a quality of existential guilt. In other words, like all the things we hold near and dear to us, we have to let go of. So we get identified with it to the point where we get identified with our anger, our frustration, our victimization. And so when something is telling us that that's not who we are not our thoughts, we are not our emotions, then who are we? There's a void there. And so there's the dizziness of freedom, you might call it, or the fear of death, because it's better to be with the devil you know than the devil you don't know. We've heard that said. There's a reason why that's said, because to enter into the void or to really admit that each moment that unfolds, we have no idea what's going to happen.
So we would sometimes rather hang on to painful things, burdening things,
that's
unhelpful things, because at least that's some kind of frame of definition for ourselves.
Right, and that's consistent with who we think we are rather than being with what is. There's a guy named
This is so great.
Tracy.
The dizziness of freedom. Yeah. Take me now. I love it.
This guy, Tracy, I forget his name, Tracy. I remember him saying, "You are not what you think you are, but what you think you are."
Whatever you think.
Yeah, so as Dr. Dre says, I got my mind on money, money on my mind. That's a form of meditation. That's your meditation. And it's worked well for him because he's making pretty good money right now.
He's got it all going. Pam in Yarmouth, Massachusetts. Pam, thanks for calling. You are on the air.
Well, thank you both for this very topical story. I've enjoyed the messages. And
good.
I wanted to say that we have a huge opiate addiction on Cape Cod. And we've got a group on the Cape called Calmer Choice, which teaches mindfulness in the schools, which has been just extremely positive. But my question for George is, does one need formal training in order to practice mindfulness? I have been in an MBSR program based on the teachings of Jon Kabat-Zinn myself. But what about for people who haven't been? How would you suggest someone engage and learn a mindfulness training effort?
Well, it's good to be around people who have been through it, and the tradition that I'm comfortable with is to have a good friend or a teacher, somebody who can guide you and can lead you to things. So part of it is formal study. Some of it is informal study. But ultimately, whatever is offered is to be investigated and explored so that you have a subjective experience of what is being offered. So to make it real, you have to feel it and you have to experience it. That's why it's really difficult for people, because talking about it is just aiming at the moon. It's not the moon itself. But once you have an experience of what it means when you're fully in a moment, or when you're able to have unwholesome thoughts and you're able to abandon them, or you're able to transform them into positive thoughts, or channel your energy like anger. If you take anger and you channel it into, okay, how do I change me, because it's usually around us. We create our own suffering, and this is what part of it is you have to have the teachings, but it's helpful to have a good friend or a teacher and to be trained, and it's ongoing training. So it is learning. As in sports, we talk about learning something, then practicing it, and then learning and practicing in 90% of it, and then 10% is just performance or being able to do it in daily life. So whether you're training with a teacher or going through the mindfulness-based stress reduction, some other training, the idea is, how is it showing up in your life from day-to-day activities? So you do the training. So to answer your question, is it's good to have people who know what it is you're trying to learn and that they can model what it is you're trying to learn. So the answer is, yeah, you need guidance. You need somebody who can do it. And sometimes books and tapes can help, but to have a real live breathing person, they can share their experience, strength, and hope with you is very helpful.
Get close to it, watch, and learn. We're talking about getting to flow with George Mumford. Hollywood, Florida, Alex is calling. Alex, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I just wanted to comment this, the zone or the in state, the mindfulness. This is something that I feel and I try to do all the time. The point I want to make is, it's not a reflective, meditative moment exclusively. This is a lifestyle you can adapt. And like anything else, with practice, you become better. But the effects on a basketball court, maybe I'm not so good at sports, but the effect in the real life is seeing the world around you in a completely new perspective. And that selflessness and that mindfulness is hard to describe, but I just wanted to say to the listeners that it's really only practice, and the benefits are further than I can explain.
Alex, I appreciate your call there. Not just the moment of meditation, obviously, but success means this becoming a way of being.
Right.
Let me get one more from Florida. Miami, Ram Giri is calling. Ram Giri, you're on the air with George Mumford.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
I'm just thrilled to hear you guys discussing this, because I've been part of this from the very beginning. I was in India in the late 60s, early 70s, and we went together to, you know, we meaning the, some of the people who are teaching this now internationally. We went together to courses, and we just soaked it up. And I have a book here in my lap. It's an early copy of a book that's coming out in November by Parvati Marcus. It's called Love Everyone. And I was just this morning reading the story of how we studied together back then. It's kind of a history of this consciousness coming to the West. I lived in Europe in 1970, I think, or 69, and I was looking for someone to teach meditation. And I had to go all over Europe to finally found somebody in Holland. This was so out of the ordinary back then, and now people understand that there is a happiness that is possible. There's a full-heartedness of how they can learn to live. And it's a matter of consciousness. It has nothing to do with religion.
Ramgiri, forgive me, but our time is down to just a minute or so here. I'm so glad for your call from Miami. George Mumford is nodding along at how rare this was some decades back. And it is kind of amazing how widespread the conversation, the awareness of this has become. Do you see it really taking hold in our culture, George? Not just in the NBA where you've worked, but well beyond at this point? How strong is the foothold?
Yes, I think it has taken hold. I consider myself, actually, with this book coming out of the closet, I've been doing this stuff for 30 years, and there's words and there's ways of communicating or even saying that I work with people who meditate, because some people, before it wasn't so welcome to express or to express that, yeah, I'm doing this. Mm-hmm. But now it's built a momentum where it's okay to come out and say, yes, I'm interested in being in a zone. I'm interested in being in the moment. I'm interested in being mindful.
George Mumford, it's been such a pleasure talking with you today, imagining your work with those players in the NBA, maybe seeing some of the results on the court. We'll think of that next game we watch next season. George Mumford's new book is The Mindful Athlete, Secrets to Pure Performance. George, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Listeners, great to have you with us today. You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.